Good morning, everyone. We're going to call the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee to order. Can we please have a roll call?
Chair Geddes?
Here.
Vice Chair Carter?
Present.
Regent Arescada?
Present.
Regent Boylan? Regent McAdoo? Regent Perkins?
Here.
You have a quorum.
Thank you. We'll go to item one, public comment. Do we have any written or submitted public comment, Winter?
No written or submitted public comment at this time.
Is there any public comment in the room in Las Vegas?
No public comment in Las Vegas.
And there is no public comment in the room here in Reno? So we will go to item number two, the consent items. And I will note that it's 2D is being withdrawn. Do I have a motion for approval of all of the consent items with the exception of 2D?
This is Regent McAdoo. I so move.
Regent Perkins, second.
I have a motion from Regent McAdoo and a second from Regent Perkins. Any questions or comments on the consent items? Hearing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item three, Great Basin College Program Proposal, BA Early Childhood Education. President Helens.
I'm having trouble with my audio.
Okay.
Sorry. So I'd like to turn this over to Vice President Rivera.
Sounds good. Vice President Rivera.
Okay. Hopefully you guys can hear me. So good morning, Regents. For the record, my name is Jake Rivera, Vice President of Student Education College. I am here today seeking approval for a new Bachelor of Arts in Early Childhood Education non-licensure. By August of 2018, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services mandated that a child development specialist must have at least a baccalaureate degree in child development, early childhood education, or a similar field. This proposed degree will meet those standards, especially for the rural and remote areas of Nevada. This proposed degree is the only fully online non-licensure program for early childhood education. This will provide access for rural Nevada and for those students who are working. The non-licensure approach was due to the workforce partners' request. Only 36% of 3 to 4 year olds in Nevada. This is due to enrollment, availability, and spending per capita. This online program focuses on working with children from birth through age 5, not birth through age 8, which is why teacher licensure in a school district setting was not included. This degree will also provide educational opportunities for individuals who are actively working in a licensed private early childhood programs to include Head Start and intertribal Head Start programs. GBC already has both a certificate and associate degree pathway. The Bachelor of ECE will provide an additional pathway while meeting the mandated education by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Currently, less than 4% of Nevada's ECE workforce has a bachelor's degree in ECE. We also receive support from various workforce entities, including Head Start of Northeastern Nevada, the Nevada Registry, United Way, Children's Cabinet, Nevada Department of Education, and multiple child care centers, just to name a few. The program would be funded by increased enrollment. We're adding 2 part-time instructors for 6 credits each semester. We already have approximately 117 current and prospective students interested in this program. This program would go in effect fall of 21. Also, I'm joined by Lynette McFarlane, our GBC faculty member in the Education Department, if you have any further questions.
Thank you, Jake. Do we have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent McAdoo, second from Regent Carter. You were cutting in and out there a bit, Jake, so there may be some questions that we need filled in there. Are there any questions or comments for Jake?
Regent Perkins here, Mr. Chair.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you. Just one quick question. Is there a pathway, if the student decides to get the non-certificate, non-certificate program, is there like a leeway or a jump for them to become, like if they choose to become certificated?
I'm going to turn that over to Lynette McFarlane.
I think you're muted, Lynette. Sorry. I'm still muted. How about now? Go ahead, Lynette, if you can.
Lynette, your microphone is muted.
Press and hold your space bar.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Lynette, we can't hear you. If Jake or...
If you could ask the question again, I'll see if I can answer that.
Okay. If
okay.
Thanks. If the student chooses to go for a licensure, since this is a non-licensure degree, is there a pathway for them to get from non-licensure to licensure?
Well, of course, we're going to see students from various states as well in this program. They would still have to go, depending on if those students are here in Nevada. There is a pathway. If they are coming from out of state, which we have seen some interest from out of state as well, those students would have to check with their state requirements.
Thank you.
Thank you, and sorry for the technical difficulty, but maybe if we could just get a little longer written response towards Regent Perkins' question as far as a path from this to licensure in Nevada or outside of Nevada, that would be great as a follow-up.
Not a problem.
Thanks. Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 4, co-requisite implementation, Vice Chancellor Abba.
Good morning. For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs. So first time back at the podium in a year and a half, this actually, oddly, I thought this would be miserable. It's not as bad as I thought, so good to be here. We wanted to highlight for you the report that is included in the reference material. This is a national report from Complete College America, No Room for Doubt, Moving Co-Requisite Support from Idea to Imperative. This is actually the third report that CCA has issued recently on co-requisite support. And what's important about this is that if you refer to page 25, they are highlighting the work in Nevada. And what they're basically showing there is that we went with this board from a discussion to full-scale implementation in the course of 3 years. And quite frankly, that's lightning speed for higher education. And so it's not often that we have good news like that, where we are highlighted in a national report. So I wanted to make sure that the board was aware of that. In addition, the entire report really is about student success and the equity imperative. And there's some really good data in there coming out of CUNY and Georgia on the substantial increases in student success and gateway course completion in those states. You have seen similar data for the state of Nevada. And also, the report spends some considerable time talking about return on investment. And I think when you look at the work that we have done in the last 3 years, we will see that return on investment in the coming years. Because the good news and the final piece of this agenda item is letting the board know that when you adopted this policy in June of 19, you gave us 2 years for full-scale implementation by fall of 21. All of the institutions will be ready this fall for full-scale implementation. And in doing so, just to highlight some of our more recent work since we last came together, since November, we have had no less than 22 professional development sessions. Those professional development sessions have been supported by Student Ready Strategies and by Complete College America. We had 9 math sessions, 10 English sessions, and 3 sessions in advising. And I think the amazing part of that is that over the course of those 22 sessions, we had over 1,300 participants across those sessions. So that's faculty and advisors who have come together to have discussions supporting implementation of this. We're actually going to continue some of those professional development sessions, and our office is sponsoring a professional development session for advising on July 9th so that we can continue these discussions throughout implementation. Also in the fall, we will begin to work on assessment. All of this is wonderful, but we've got to go back and take a critical look at the work that we have done in terms of implementation to make sure that it truly does what we said it was going to do, which is improve student success. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would just ask that everybody, when you have an opportunity, please review the report and take a moment to appreciate the hard work of your institutions. Thank you.
Thank you. And I just want to comment for the board members there, you know, several of you have heard me through the years talk about remedial education, and this was a priority when I was an undergraduate student back in 1988. And I think this co-requisite model is the first time we're really moving the needle and we're really making changes and we're supporting the students in remediation that they want to. And this is one of the items that we pushed down as a board. We got pushback from faculty. Appropriately so, because faculty own their curriculum, but the way faculty have accepted this and engaged it and are implementing it, I truly appreciate that they've all gotten on board and are moving this forward, and I think all of our students will be better off for this co-rec model and the way all the faculty have developed it and are moving it forward. So I appreciate all the work, Vice Chancellor, of your office, but then all of the campuses and the faculty for actually making this work. So truly appreciate it. We generally try not to push things down from our level, but sometimes we do have to push, and it's great when everybody gets on board and makes a positive change. So with that, are there any questions or comments?
Mr. Chair? Yes.
Regent McAdoo.
Yes, I just want to also extend my appreciation and thank you really to the entire team. This is a prime example of together we can accomplish so much more. And I'm really grateful for all the work that Vice Chancellor Abba's department has done, the institutions have done, the regents have done. I just think it's a great picture for us to move forward really working together. And there are always hurdles that we have to cross, but we've done it. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, that was info only, so we'll go to item number 5, FAFSA simplification, implications for student financial aid. Assistant Vice Chancellor Renee Davis.
Good morning, and thank you very much for asking me to come talk about FAFSA simplification, Chair Geddes and Vice Chair Carter. Happy to do that and to spread some good news in regards to the FAFSA and some other related factors that will affect aid packages going forward for our students. So while I'm waiting for my slides to come up, hopefully they will come up, I'll just give you a quick summary of what we're going to be talking about today. The genesis of this change in the Consolidated Appropriations Act of 2021. I'll do an overview of the actual FAFSA changes, talk a little bit about the student aid index, which is going to replace the EFC, which we've talked about many times in the past. Pell Grant eligibility determinations also have been modified. And cost of attendance changes, and finally, impact on our aid programs here in Nevada. So I've got a full list of things to talk, so I'm going to try to keep on track. Let's go to the next slide, please. And you can go one more. Next slide. Okay, here we go. So the sometimes referred to as the Corona bus, as you all know, there was an omnibus bill passed by Congress back in December, and that's where these FAFSA changes were enacted. And so in addition to the FAFSA changes that will go into effect in 2023-24, there were some additional appropriations to increase the Pell Grant, and then for what we call the campus-based program, so federal work study, and then also the Federal Supplemental Opportunity Grant, or FSEOG. So next slide. Some of you might be wondering, what about the Higher Education Act? That is supposed to be renewed by Congress every 5 years. As a lot of you know, that doesn't seem to happen on schedule. It was last renewed in 2008. And so the changes have happened to the federal student aid programs in various ways, as a series of temporary extensions or additions to other bills. So it's not been done in one kind of comprehensive bill for a while, but as you can see, there still has been progress made. So next slide, please. I'm going to start with the FAFSA changes. Again, these are effective for the 23-24 award year, which means that's the FAFSA that's going to come out in October 2022. Next slide. So just a kind of basic summary of the more obvious changes. So the current FAFSA is 108 questions. Now, not every student answers every single question because there is skip logic contained within the application. But there still has been a substantial reduction in the number of questions, down to 36. One change also in the bill was that previously the application was available in English and Spanish only, and now there's language in the bill about the 11 most common languages spoken by English language learner students. So it'll be interesting to see what the list looks like of those languages. And it is quite a bit for the U.S. Department of Education to implement in actually what's relatively short period of time. And then, again, as I mentioned, the 2023-24 FAFSA will come out on October 1st, 2022. The one that's currently out is still under the old format. Next slide. A couple of really positive changes that were made for the FAFSA is that two questions which have been barriers to students are being removed from the FAFSA. So one was the selective service question, and the other is the drug conviction question. Those are both going away beginning 2023-24. Ed could implement those earlier according to the legislation, but it may be unlikely just due to logistics. Next slide. There is a change in the way families report their assets in the new application. As I mentioned before, there has always been skip logic, but there's been some modification to it. And so basically what this means is students who meet any of those bullets, such as they're getting means-tested benefits, they don't need to answer those extra asset questions, so it makes the FAFSA simpler for those families who have a low income. Next slide. So the next thing I wanted to talk about a little bit is the change from EFC to Student Aid Index. So Estimated Family Contribution, Student Aid Index, they really both are intended as a measure of what the student and their family can contribute towards the cost of education. But the SAI is more obviously an index, where there used to be lots of confusion back when I worked in the aid office. Estimated family contribution, students and their families would see that in the letter and they would think, oh, that's how much money I have to actually come up, you know, cash and hand over. But it really was meant to represent what they put towards their, you know, cost of just living over the whole year and including the cost of education. So hopefully it's gonna simplify things for students. And one really major change in terms of aid packages is that we're going from the minimum value at zero, and then now there's a new minimum value of 1500. And what that means is that rather than having such a huge cluster at zero, we're going to be able to differentiate for the neediest students. We'll have that negative SAI. Next slide. Okay, so I'm going to shift to aid eligibility and cost of attendance because there were some changes in the bill that affected cost of attendance in the for the first time. So let's
sorry, Renee,
go.
Real quick. Is the FAFSA still tied to the IRS database? So
yes.
All that's automatically.
Yes, that okay. is still tied, and they're actually looking at ways to improve some of that back and forth. But yes, it is still going to be there. So that will be a help. Go ahead to the next slide. So the Pell Grant awarding methodology changes are fairly extensive. And so I'm going to try not to spend too much time on them, but you have a little more information on the slides that will help explain. But essentially, every award used to be based on the EFC, but now there's a new model that will take into consideration an income calculation, which I'll get into on the next slides. And then there are actually two new categories of students who will qualify for the maximum Pell Grant. And you can see the bullets there, but they're essentially students whose parents died in serving in the U.S. Armed Forces after September 11, 2001. And then a similar provision for those in the line of duty as a public safety officer. Next slide. So as I said, the SAI is going to be used to determine eligibility, but the Pell Grant has some additional logic. So basically a student is going to get considered first for the maximum Pell Grant. And if they don't qualify for the maximum, then there's going to be a calculation of the maximum Pell amount minus the SAI value. And then if the student doesn't get Pell from either of those methods, then there's a minimum calculation. And I provided a link to in the materials, and also there's a link on the slide to this nifty. I don't know if the camera can not really see that very well, but there's a nifty little chart published by NASFA that kind of puts that logic into a flow chart. So it makes a little more sense. Let's go ahead and go to the next slide. So maximum Pell for dependent students, you can see that there's a measure based on the AGI is below 225% of poverty level for a single parent or for two parents below 175% of the federal poverty level. And so I think it's going to take too much time to go through in detail each of these slides, so I'm going to let that go at that, and let's go to the next slide. Okay, so that was for dependent students. For now, for independent students, it's very similar, although we're now talking about rather than the student's parents, the student actually being the parent. So it's a very similar structure, and you can see down at the bottom in number three, the minimum Pell calculation, that percentage of federal poverty level is actually a little higher than for the previous group. So go ahead and go to the next slide. One thing that also is changing is Pell Grant for incarcerated students. Right now, the only incarcerated students eligible for Pell are those whose schools are participating in an experimental program. This will now be open to all institutions, but an institution, unlike other aid, which is just covered by the broad application to the feds, there will be a specific application to participate in that program. So our institutions would need to apply should they choose to participate. Go ahead, next slide. And subsidized loans. So there was a change in the bill also in regards to subsidized loans. And that's basically there was a hard deadline of 150% of your program length, beyond which you could not get subsidized loans, which are loans where the government's paying the interest while you're in school. And it wasn't appealable under what they called SULA. And so now it's going to go back to the regular. Students still have to meet satisfactory academic progress, but should they have a successful appeal, they could potentially get subsidized loan dollars if they need them and if they qualify. And all the loan limits that were previously in place remain in place. Go to the next slide. Cost of attendance. So this is kind of a big one. So for the first time, the U.S. Department of Education is going to be able to regulate the cost of attendance. Previously, there was a very minimal regulation just based on the what was in the Code of Federal Regulations. Now, the U.S. Department of Education is going to be able to write regulations about all of these elements except for tuition and fees. And so you can see the list. I've talked about this a lot before. What comprises the cost of attendance? It goes well beyond just what it costs to pay for your courses and for your books. So the elements, in addition to the tuition and fees, books and supplies, are, of course, room and board, which can be the most expensive portion of the student's costs. There's a miscellaneous personal category. There's a loan fee category, which was optional in the past. It's now mandatory, and the schools must use actual rather than like an average or a usual loan fee amount. And then the first professional licensure also was an optional item that is going to be more on the mandatory side at this point. And then there's a provision about making the cost of attendance publicly available, which our institutions do already. But it sounds like the law probably as implemented will mean that it might have to be placed on more places on the website and or with extra links. So we'll figure out those fine details as that goes into implementation. Next slide. So I just wanted to, for those of you who aren't familiar with the cost of attendance, to just give you kind of the idea of what our institutional cost of attendance look like. That's mostly there for your reference. Next slide. And that's the first one was off campus with parents, and then one more slide on campus, which affects four of our institutions now. We'll go to the next slide. So just wanted to end up with the takeaways, the impact on students and aid programs. So next slide. So in general, the FAFSA simplification really is a simplification. So it actually is going to help students and families fill out the FAFSA. I, as a former aid administrator, well, I guess I'm still a current aid administrator in some ways, really hope that one of the results is that people stop saying the FAFSA is hard to fill out. Because every time I hear that and my colleagues hear that, we cringe because it feels like that's not the right thing to be telling students because it causes some anxiety and in the potential for them to not fill it out. The replacement of the EFC with the SAI, as I mentioned, we're hoping that that will make it easier again for students to understand when it comes time to talk about their aid packages. I already mentioned that the negative SAI will better allow us to kind of figure out who the absolute neediest of our students are and then perhaps target more institutional aid in that direction. But in the end, in regards to the Pell distribution, it's hard to say whether we're going to have more students or fewer students, because one change that I can't remember if I added a slide or not, but it has to do with the calculation of the EFC at the very end. If a family had more than one student in college, then it would be divided, say, for two, divided in half. That actually is not going to happen anymore. So what that means is that there are probably going to be a shift in the Pell distribution away from some higher income families who maybe went with two in college, might have qualified, with maybe in one they did not. So it's still going to be interesting to see how the distribution shifts, but we'll have to wait a little while to find that out. And next slide. So for our state programs, no impact to GGMS because it's, as you know, a merit-based program. No FAFSA is required. For SSOG, we think that more students will likely fall within the EFCSI eligibility, but again, that is a little bit of an unknown based on that Pell calculation change, the SAI calculation change. And we really do think, though, that the negative SIA will create more students qualifying for the maximum SSOG. because what we've seen over the years is that students who have the at-home budget, which is the smallest budget, sometimes they don't qualify for the maximum SSOG due to that, the size of their cost of attendance. And now that there would be a negative, that would, you know, there's a little more leeway there. And then for Nevada Promise, you know, potentially more students might complete the FAFSA. We don't really know, again, what's going to happen. But we think gradually some of that anxiety around filling out the FAFSA may be minimized. Next slide. In terms of institutional aid, each of our institutions has its own packaging philosophy. But again, I'm not going to say for the fifth time about the negative SAI, but that will have an impact. On this slide, I did say it will likely result in more Pell recipients, but actually, again, that's unknown. That's speculation. So we'll have to see. Next slide. And that's all. I'll make myself available for questions, should there be any.
Thank you, Renee. And maybe it's a question for Chancellor Rose later, but I thought there was a bill to provide assistance for students to fill out the FAFSA that was passed. Did that get passed, or did that not, or do we know?
That bill did pass.
Yeah, and okay. That's, yeah, it's mostly, I think, a K-12 targeted bill.
Right, so it was in high school to help the students fill out FAFSA so more of them would do it, which could change that. And then on the cost of attendance, as we do those calculations, does the federal government specify how we do those calculations? Or in looking at it, you know, I know like around here, the price of housing is skyrocketed and it's become an issue. But how do they determine that and make sure it's a level field?
Well, right now, there really is very little guidance, and the Department of Ed can't really boss the institutions around in that regard. But there are, you know, of course, within the financial aid community, lots of best practices. And, you know, it ranges from surveying students, you know, kind of looking at the market. And each campus might have a slightly different approach. Sometimes institutions collaborate, like I think NSC and CSN and UNLV, I think they kind of keep in touch on the housing, even though they have, you know, different pockets, you know, different communities where the differential might exist. But now going forward, there will be more rules around that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Regent Carter?
Yeah, I just wanted to thank you so much for presenting this. When this came up at another agenda item, I really wanted to make sure that this was on our radar, that this change was happening, so that we can kind of track it as maybe formal guidelines or different guidelines come down and change. So thank you very much for presenting this for us.
Seeing no other questions or comments, that was info only, so we'll go to item number 6, handbook revision. Requirements for admission to the universities, Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic and Student Affairs and Community Colleges. I would now refer the committee to the reference material, which includes a briefing paper and policy proposal concerning admission requirements to the universities. So again, to be very clear, this agenda item is only applicable to the universities. A little bit of history on this, going back to March 2012, the board adopted a policy requiring that the universities require that students that are seeking admission to the universities take the ACT or SAT. You did not have to achieve a specific score. However, there are multiple pathways to admission, including GPA and ACT or SAT score. What this essentially does is eliminate that requirement to take it. And why are we doing this? As you, many of you are already well aware, there is an ongoing dialogue nationally about equity concerns and access regarding these tests. In addition, UNR and UNLV have recently discontinued their longstanding practice of utilizing these test scores for the purpose of determining scholarship eligibility. So we felt that it was appropriate at this time to remove that barrier. You will notice that included in the reference material is a letter of support from UNR and UNLV. And I will also note that statewide administration of the ACT in the junior year is going to continue, and the elimination of this requirement does not preclude us in any way from continuing to receive the data that we receive via the SLDS that supports, for example, our college readiness data dashboard. So we'll still have all of that data. It simply removes the barrier for students. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would request approval of the item and ask if there are any questions of the committee.
Do I have a motion for approval? So motion from Regent Arascata, second from Regent Carter.
Second. Oh, okay.
Hello, Regent Boylan. Any questions or comments on the motion?
Quick comment.
Regent Arascata.
In my opinion, standardized tests do not measure the student's potential. Student's potential is internal. There's great success that can be accomplished by not having to be subjected to these type of testing. I in great support of the removal of these. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 7, handbook revision in-state tuition for certain veterans. Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, this is a very technical item, so please bear with me as I try to explain the history and make sure that everyone understands what we're proposing here. This relates to the federal provisions that I typically refer to as the CHOICE Act. You have before you a briefing paper and a policy proposal. So let's start with the history. Going back to 2015, these provisions were adopted by the board in order to comply with federal law. The federal law that was passed at that time was referred to as the CHOICE Act. What the CHOICE Act did was provide that covered individuals, so these are veterans that are receiving certain veterans benefits, Chapter 33, which is the post-9/11 GI Bill, Chapter 30, the Montgomery Active Duty Bill, Chapter 31, among them. So in order to receive this benefit under federal law, you had to have served for at least 90 days and be receiving any one of these veterans' benefits. You also had to matriculate within 3 years of discharge. Now, the purpose for the 3 years, and the federal government was very specific in terms of their intent in selecting the 3 years, was because they felt that 3 years was an appropriate period of time for a veteran to assimilate back into civilian life. So by being a covered individual under this provision, you are deemed a resident for tuition purposes. So that means that an individual who may have been stationed in South Dakota, Texas, Utah, could come to an ENSHE institution and be considered a resident for the purpose of tuition, and therefore assimilate and become a citizen of Nevada. Over time, there has been a number of dialogues among various veterans groups and considerable pressure to eliminate that three-year requirement. And in January of 2001, Congress passed the Johnny Isaacson and David P. Rowe Veterans Health Care and Benefits Improvement Act, which is effective August 1st of this year. And what it did was essentially remove that time requirement. So in doing so, that means as long as you are a covered individual, in order to be deemed a resident for tuition purposes, if you are not otherwise a resident of the state of Nevada, you can come to Nevada and attend one of our institutions and be considered a resident for tuition purposes. Now, I did receive the question as I reviewed this item with various regents of whether or not individuals who receive benefits under any of these chapters, again, Chapter 33, Chapter 30, or 31, so everything from the GI Bill to the VOC rehab provisions, if you are dishonorably discharged, can you receive those benefits and therefore be considered a resident for tuition purposes? And the answer is no. There are various discharge types. Typically, it's honorable or other than an honorable discharge. But in general, these are individuals who served their country well, and therefore they are eligible for these benefits. And by virtue of being eligible for those benefits and removing the three-year time constraint, but retaining the 90-day service period, you will receive this benefit. Again, it is effective August 1st. This particular proposal will be effective upon passage and approval by this board. One of the reasons that we need to make sure that we do approve this is so that we stay in line with the federal provisions, because if we do not, we are at risk as of institutions of losing our ability to serve those students with veterans benefits. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions and request approval of the handbook revisions amending Title IV, Chapter 15, Section 3.
And thank you, Crystal. I think you made it clear there, but do we need to make any changes to our handbook as regards to honorable or dishonorable, or is it very set out in the federal?
That's coming on a future agenda. That's next on the agenda.
All right.
A little further down the agenda. Different issue, but a little further down the agenda.
Okay. Any questions or comments? Do I have a motion for approval?
I'll make the motion. Okay.
Motion from Regent Boylan, second from Regent Arascotta.
Yes.
Any further comments or questions? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 8, handbook revision, eliminating the excess credit fee. Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs and Community Colleges. Before you is a handbook revision that would eliminate the excess credit fee. When this provision was originally adopted in 2012, I lovingly referred to it as the tough love policy. I no longer have that love for this policy because it has had many, many challenges over the years, and we've had that discussion with the board on several occasions. I think what's more important at this time is there are a number of national reports. One of them is cited here, the American Educational Research Association, and other states that have adopted an excess credit fee. There really isn't a great deal of evidence showing that this type of tough love supports students in terms of student completion. So what exactly did the excess credit fee do? If a student accumulated 150% or more of the credits required for their program of study, we punished them with a surcharge. And so we had that in place for a period of time. It is very difficult to isolate in the data our improvements in student success if it is specific to this provision or to other provisions. Obviously, as the chancellor takes on a strategic planning process, we're going to look at all kinds of policies. So something's going to replace this, and it won't be a punishment, essentially. If I could refer you specifically to page 3 of the proposal where we, and you'll see here that we're amending various sections of the handbook that reference the excess credit fee by deleting that reference. But what I want to point out to the board is that this would be effective this fall. So as of this fall, no one's going to charge this fee. And going forward, periodically or upon the request of the board, institutions will report on the accumulation of excess credits by students and what steps they are taking to mitigate this. At this time, all of the institutions, through the generation of the revenue that came from charging the excess fee, everybody's got an excess credit fee account, and they all have balances in there. And you will notice that on the briefing paper, back to page 1, there is a provision there that indicates that institutions, and I would request that your motion be specific to this, require institutions to expend their balances in the excess credit fee in accordance with the policy, which basically says you've got to spend it on advising. We have contacted all of the institutions, and most of them have indicated that their balances will be fully expended by the end of FY22, so they can all make the deadline by FY23. Mr. Chairman, in approving this item, I would request that the board member who makes the motion clearly indicate that there is an expectation that these fee balances be fully expended by the end of FY23. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for elimination of the excess credit fee with the fee balances spent out by the end of FY23?
Mr. Chair, is it 22 or 23?
FY23 is the requirement. Most of them said they could have it done by FY22, but FY23 is in the briefing paper and would be the requirement.
Very good. Some moved.
Motion from Regent Carter, second from Regent Arascotta.
Yes.
I will support the motion. I am hesitant. I like some of the tough love policies that we created. And I think we've been improving continuation rates and graduation rates with some of the tough love policies, but if this one doesn't make sense at this point in time, I will support the motion. Regent McAdoo? Did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We're going to skip number 9 and come back to that. We'll go to number 10, Handbook Revision, National Guard Fee Waiver. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Crystal Abba, for the record. So these next 4 items that I will cover are all provisions of state law that have been revised through the 21 session. They're all either effective July 1 or they were effective upon passage and approval, and they fall within the general jurisdiction of this committee. So what we're doing here is we're aligning all of the handbook provisions with the revisions in state law, and by doing so, we are putting the institutions on notice of these changes so that appropriate steps can be taken for implementation. So starting with the first provision, by the way, when this material was prepared, the bill had been enrolled but not signed by the governor. It has been signed by the governor, Chapter 353, and this concerns the National Guard fee waiver. You will see in the policy proposal and briefing paper before you, let's start on page 3. The purpose of this provision, the purpose of AB 156, was essentially to expand the existing provisions for the National Guard fee waiver in such a manner that it would incentivize National Guard members to re-enlist. The way the current program works, active duty members of the National Guard or recruits may receive a fee waiver. And these are typically, obviously, as they're a member of the Nevada National Guard, they're typically residents of Nevada, but we deem them residents for the purpose of PeopleSoft and all of that. But under that current program, which has been in place for well over a decade, I think approaching 20 years, that fee waiver provided that that member of the National Guard or the child or spouse of a member of the National Guard that was killed in performing the duties of a National Guard member could receive this waiver. And it was for undergraduate or graduate programs. They had to maintain a semester GPA of 2.0. But what it basically does is it waives the base registration fee and laboratory fees for state-supported courses. So that means that that cost is absorbed by the institutions. We do not collect that revenue. But under the funding formula, we do get student credit hour course completions for that. So it does impact, we get state funding from that perspective. We did work with the Guard on this, and we were approached by Ms. Titus in working on this, so because we wanted to make sure that this was something that we could implement, that there wasn't language that didn't make sense in terms of implementation. And so the way this is basically set up, that it is slightly different from what we're doing for the active duty member in that it is for undergraduate programs only. So you will see on page 4, that beginning of subsection 4 there, it says for the spouse and child, it is specific to associate bachelor's or a certificate at any institution within the system. So this is a reassignment of the benefit, okay? So what it means, and again, remember the purpose of this is to incentivize reenlistment. So an individual, and I will use myself as an example, if I'm a member of the Nevada National Guard and I used the waiver in my original term of enlistment, I used the waiver, and then I reenlist and I assign it to my child. And then I reenlist again and I assign it to my spouse. Each time I reenlist, I can assign it to someone else. I cannot reassign it during one period of reenlistment if the person that I assigned it to uses it. So the key is you give it to them and they shouldn't use it unless they actually are going to use it all the way through because, and the Guard felt very strongly about that because they want to send a message that when you use it, you're going to use it. It also has the same provisions similar to the active duty members of the 2.0, and you have to be in good standing. In terms of fiscal impact, you will notice on the bottom of the briefing paper that we were not able to determine the fiscal impact, obviously, because we don't know the number of individuals that will reenlist and reassign the benefit. That said, so that you are all aware in the vein of full disclosure, the current program costs the system about $2.4 million a year. I will tell you that as indicated on the record by General Jerome Guerrero, And in our conversations with him, on average, it's about 300 individuals that reenlist. However, obviously, the purpose of this is to increase those reenlistment numbers. And again, we cannot accurately predict those that will reenlist and then reassign their benefit. So that is basically it in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman. And again, what we are doing here is aligning board policy with the provisions of state law as amended under AB 156. And with that, I would answer any questions or request your approval.
Thank you. And when you said Ms. Titus, that's Assemblywoman Robin Titus?
Yes. Thank you.
Who was the sponsor of the bill?
Yes.
Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Boyle? Yes, Regent Boylan?
Yes, I do approve it, but I do have a question of a Vice Chancellor.
I'll take your motion, and as soon as we get a second, I'll come back to you.
Thank you.
Second from Regent Ariscotta.
I have a statement also.
And a second.
I have a statement also.
Okay.
Yes, and a statement. Yes, and
so
a second.
Motion from Regent Boylan, second from Regent Ariscotta. Then we'll go to Regent Boylan and back to Regent Ariscotta. Regent Boylan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Vice Chancellor Abba. Firstly, it's the great stuff she does and explain things to me. I was more lost than knowledgeable after reading all the stuff she does, but she does a great job explaining. I have one question. She said something like you have to use it when you use it or something, referring to giving it to one of your either child or spouse. I really didn't understand that part. You have to use it when you use it. It's kind of what was that?
Use it or you. Thank you, Regent Boylan, for that question. I apologize for any confusion. So let me give the example again. I'm an active duty member and I assign the benefit to my child. And my first child takes a couple of courses and decides, nope, this isn't for me, and he drops out. With that, within that same period of enlistment, I can't reassign it to my daughter. I have to wait until I reenlist again. So that reassignment can only happen once during the period of reenlistment. Now, I could reassign it to my daughter if when I first assigned it to my son, if he never used it. That's the key. Once you use it for that period, you then can't reassign it. I hope that makes sense.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much. It does. It's a simple thing as usual. And I appreciate your explanation again. Thank you, ma'am.
My pleasure.
Regent Ariscotta.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. Just a simple statement. I'd recommend that for future legislative sessions that the board adopt a position to oppose any fee waivers, as I consider it an unfunded mandate. Thank you.
Thank you, Regent Ariscotta. Any other questions or comments? Regent McAdoo?
Yes, I just want to clarify in my note taking, I thought I heard Vice Chancellor Abba say to comply with AB 156. And is it 165 or is it 156? I just want to be clear in my own head. Thank you.
For the record, Crystal Abba, it is 156. Okay. 165 is the next agenda item.
Okay, thank you. I have all this on my screen. I must have been looking at the wrong one. Thank you.
No worries.
Thank you. And yeah, by this series of agenda items and seeing the legislative report we'll be getting later, it does appear the legislature does have great sway over the Nevada Association of Higher Education, despite some who publicly testify otherwise. With that, all in favor of approval of agenda item 10, signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We will now go to item number 11, handbook revision in-state tuition for certain veterans, AB 165, Regent McAdoo.
Regent McAdoo?
I'm there. Thank you.
Vice Chancellor.
I'm here too.
I was just
I get it.
I was queuing her notes.
By the time I get done with this, who knows what I'll be calling myself. Okay, for the record, Crystal Abba. And Mr. Chairman, if I could just take a moment, I realized I forgot something very, very important, which is, as you can imagine, there is a considerable breadth of work here in preparing these items, and I owe a debt of gratitude to my staff, specifically Tarina Caserto and Renee Davis. Thank you both, because we've been batting these things around for a long time, and then you get to the end, and it's a frenzy. And I just really appreciate their diligence and their good work. So thank you. All right. So this item is with respect to AB 165, Ms. McAdoo. So now we're on the same page. And this concerns honorably discharged individuals. Now, I am going to do my darndest to try to explain this with respect to Agenda Item 7, which was the Choice Act, because they're a little bit the same, but they're a little bit different. And I beg that you bear with me, because this is very technical. And what's the saying of Einstein? If you can't explain it to a six-year-old, you don't understand it yourself. So this will be my test, okay? All right, so first of all, I want to give some history. And if you could specifically turn to page 3, you'll see that this is very straightforward. And if you actually compare subsection 9 of Title 4, Chapter 15, Section 3 to the bill, it is exactly the same. And it aligns with the revisions to NRS 396-540. NRS 396-540 directs the Board of Regents to deem individuals residents for tuition purposes under certain circumstances. So when you look at that section of state law, it's a laundry list of categories of individuals that are deemed residents for tuition purposes. And in 2013, I have always referred to it as the Elliott Anderson provision, because Assemblyman Elliott Anderson was the first one to adopt this. And notice, this is pre-Choice Act. Choice Act was 2015. Choice Act is with respect, remember, the Choice Act item number 7 deemed individuals residents for tuition purposes if they were covered individuals. So you had to be receiving certain federal benefits. This is, we are going to deem you a resident for tuition purposes if you are honorably discharged. When the provision was originally adopted in 2013, you had to be dishonorably discharged and enroll within 2 years of the discharge, okay? Then they came back in 2015 and bumped it up to 5 years. So that means I'm dishonorably discharged. I could come to an institution in Nevada and be considered a resident for tuition purposes as long as I matriculated within 5 years of the discharge period. What this basically does is eliminate that. And I will say, and this is where the layover comes, where these two kind of mesh up against each other. Many honorably discharged individuals who are recently discharged are covered under Chapter 33, Chapter 31, or Chapter 30 of federal veterans education benefits. In other words, that's where they overlay, because many of these individuals, if they're covered individuals receiving federal veterans educational benefits, they would have been covered under Agenda Item 7. Where this is an expansion is, think of that veteran who was honorably discharged from, say, I'll just throw this out there, the Vietnam War, okay? He's not covered by any of those chapters now, but if he comes to Nevada and he was previously a resident in Utah, Colorado, or wherever, he comes here, he will now be deemed a resident for tuition purposes. I think the fiscal impact on this, given the overlay with the other bill, is probably minimal, but as you can see from the fiscal note there, that we can't estimate how many individuals who wouldn't otherwise qualify under the Choice Act were gonna come here. That's even more complicated. But obviously, this does, the state is making their own message very clear in their desire to honor veterans as they assimilate back to civilian life, and particularly those individuals who serve their country well and were honorably discharged. So with that, I hope I passed the Einstein test, and I would ask you to adopt the provision. Forgot what I was here for.
Do I have a motion for approval of the in-state tuition for certain veterans?
Motion.
Motion from Regent Arascata. Second.
I'll second it.
Regent Boylan.
I have a comment also.
And a comment from Regent Arascata.
Once again, we're receiving another unfunded mandate. As a very proud retiree of the VA hospital, I'm 100% in for veterans' rights. However, but I would recommend, once again, that for future legislative sessions, that the board adopt a position to oppose any fee waivers as I consider those unfunded mandates. Thank you.
Thank you. Regent Boylan, did you have a comment?
Yes, sir. Thank you. My comment was the same, actually, as Regent Arascada. I was just going to copy what he said for the last one to apply here, too. I think it's a wonderful idea, Regent Arascada. It's really good. Thank you, sir.
And I will say I support all of these fee waivers, and I appreciate what we're doing for the veterans, and the veterans have given us a great service, and it is our position to serve them, and we just need to make sure we budget for it appropriately.
Yes,
sir. Seeing no other comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 12, handbook revision, tuition and fee waiver, Native Americans, AB 262, Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, you have before you a briefing paper and policy proposal to align the board handbook with the adopted provisions of Assembly Bill 262, which provides a fee waiver under certain circumstances for certain Native American students. This bill was signed by the governor and is effective on July 1 and will be under Chapter 349 of Statutes of Nevada. If you would please refer to page 3 of the policy proposal, I will walk you through this. So we've talked about the National Guard fee waiver. This is a fee waiver for Native American students who are a member of a federally recognized tribe or nation, all or part of which is located in Nevada. And by our count, in contacting the Intertribal Council of Nevada and the Nevada Indian Commission, there are 27 tribes and bands located in Nevada. Now, that does not include those that may be in California or Utah and bordering up against, but there are 27 located inside the state of Nevada. This also applies, and this is where it does get a little bit murky, is to a descendant of a member of one of those tribes. It does not define descendant, but an individual who is certified by either the tribe or the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a descendant would be considered for this fee waiver. And this fee waiver works a little bit differently than the National Guard fee waiver, so bear with me as I explain that. You have to be a resident of the state for 1 year, you have to be admitted to an institution, and you have to complete the FAFSA because this is a last dollar waiver. So an individual who is, for example, a member of the Walker River Paiute tribe, they complete the FAFSA, they've resided in the state for a year, and they get a bill. And that bill includes the base registration fee and laboratory fees, which is the same as the National Guard fee waiver, but it goes beyond that, including all other mandatory fees. So that means counseling fees, recycling fees, all the various fees that have been adopted by the institutions. When federal aid, which includes the Pell Grant, SEOG, TEACH, your typical federal packages, but in addition, federal benefits for veterans are included in that. So if you fall under any of those chapters, Chapter 33, that would be taken out as well. Whatever is left over, that cost would be absorbed by the institution. Now, the legislature did put in language that we can offset those waivers with gifts, grants, donations, and other federal sources other than the ones I've noted, but it does not preclude an institution from absorbing that cost if they do not receive those gifts, grants, or donations. And these individuals would need to maintain a 2.0 GPA for continuing eligibility. So if they don't receive that 2.0 GPA, they would lose it, and there is no provision in the bill for reinstatement. That is important to note. In looking at the bill, we did prepare a fiscal note where we pulled student record level data for what we had. So I cannot look at PeopleSoft and tell if you are, what tribe you are a member of, if you disclose to us that you are a Native American. I can just tell that you're a Native American based on the race and ethnicity that you selected on your admissions application. So what we did, because it was the best information that we had, we looked at all student record level data for students that had disclosed that they were Native Americans. We looked at their fees, we took out federal aid, and we estimated that price tag at $1.9 million. Now, the challenge with that number is some of those students may not be members of a Nevada tribe. They may be members of a tribe that has historical ties to Colorado or Oregon or some other, one of the other 500 tribes that are recognized in the state. However, it is important to note that the purpose of this, of course, is to incentivize individuals, Native Americans, to come to the institution. I know that Regent Geddes has been contacted by a tribe locally, and they would like to begin a conversation about implementation, and I'm happy to discuss that. So with the fiscal impact of that and having summarized how this will generally work, I am happy to answer any questions and request approval of the new addition of a Section 15 to Title IV, Chapter 17 that would provide for fee waivers for Native American students who are members of tribes that are located here in Nevada and their descendants. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you. I do make that motion. Do I have a second?
I'll second with comment.
Second from Regent Arascata. And in the motion, there is a slight typo on the top of page 4 that if you could just correct that before we codify it in the spelling of waiver.
Thank you.
And then I will say I wanted to make that motion because I do truly support this one. I think our Nevada Native Americans have given us all quite a bit with the land that all of our institutions are on, and we have a service to give back to them. And the fiscal note does concern me, but I think it is something we can just keep working on. And Regent Arascata had a comment.
Vice Chancellor Abba, over the past, for agenda item 10, 11, 12, for the items that were just presented to us, what is the cumulative dollar amount for each of those items of that we're going to be absorbing? Do you have a dollar amount that we're going to be, we, the system, will be absorbing?
No. On each of those items, there is a fiscal note noted, and for many of them, we cannot predict that impact. For this particular item, we estimated it very conservatively with the information that we had at $1.9 million. I do expect that for the National Guard fee waiver and the expansion for reenlistment, I just don't know where those numbers are going to be. However, there is an annual report that comes to the board where we report on fee waivers, so you will be receiving that information regularly.
Okay. And those representatives in Carson City will also receive those?
We can absolutely give them a copy. It is public information, so they will have access to that as well.
Perfect. Once again, I'd recommend that for future legislative sessions that the board adopt a position to oppose any fee waivers, as I consider it an unfunded mandate. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments?
Yes. Mr. Chair, I think both of us have questions up here or comments. For
Regent Carter?
Vice Chancellor Abba, when you did your preliminary breakdown, did you have it by institution by any chance?
No. I mean, I could break it down that way, but the way we did it, no, we gave the fiscal department so that Andrew could use that in his works with the legislature. We just gave him an aggregate number, but I can go back and break it down. I will tell you that proportionally, if you look at the proportion of Native American students, GBC has the greatest percentage. And it's not double digits or anything. It's like less than 5, but it's because of their size and because of their location, and they already have strong relationships with the local tribes in that area. So I don't want to be alarmist, but I think of all the institutions, I think GBC may see the most significant impact, but that's yet to be determined.
Okay. That was the direction my question was. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Regent McAdoo?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I just wondered if there is any provision that would allow or not allow us to seek funding from our federal delegation for this particular bill, because I feel like it is exactly what you said about what the Native Americans in Nevada have done for Nevada. I believe that's true federally, but I would have to say I don't know the answer to that. I just want to know if there are any provisions that would allow us to do that or not allow us to do that. Thank you.
For the record, Crystal Abbott, there are no provisions that would preclude us from doing that. So I would say, yes, we can absolutely begin those discussions and see where they go. But there's nothing in the bill or any other provision of state law that I am aware of that would preclude us from having those dialogues and seeking federal funding for these types of provisions.
I would recommend that, please.
Thank you. And I think that is spelled out in Section 9, that we can get waiver from gifts, grants, donations, and federal sources. So I think that specifically allows us to do so. And as Vice Chancellor Abbott mentioned, I've been in contact with some of the tribal members as far as implementation. And as I have dialogues with them, I'll bring that back to the committee and to the board and see if there's other things we can do, as well as working with them on the federal funding with Chancellor Rose.
And Mr. Chairman, yes. if you'll indulge me, there's also a reporting provision in here that I failed to mention. And I think it's important to note that when you look across the system, our enrollment for Native American students is abysmally low. There is absolutely no doubt about that. And so I think that to the extent that this provides additional access to those students, that is, it's an imperative. But the question is, you know, somewhere there has to be a balance there. And that's why the legislature was requesting that over time we report to them regularly on the number of students that receive this and what is that aggregate dollar value. According to the bill, that report needs to be submitted to the Legislative Council Bureau. In the handbook, we are indicating that not only will it go to the Council Bureau, but of course it will go to you as well. So you will be receiving regular reports that indicate the figures associated with these provisions.
And I will note, the board really had we'd launched an initiative to improve the access and retention and graduation of our Nevada Native American students in right before the recession. Regent Don Darrow was a big champion of it, and we had met with a few of the tribes, and we had started an initiative, and then when the recession hit, everything stopped, unfortunately. So I think we have an opportunity here to restart it. And Regent Del Carlo, did you have a question or comment?
I do. Thank you, Chair Geddes. I would like to ask Vice Chancellor Abba, are there other states that have done this legislation that, or are you aware of any? And what would their fiscal notes be? Do you know?
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs, I am familiar with the provisions that have been recently adopted in Colorado and provisions that exist in Oregon. They are not fee waivers. In those cases, for Colorado, it's tribes that are located or historically tied to the state of Colorado. They deem them residents for tuition purposes. So they basically don't have to be, they're not going to pay non-resident tuition. But it's if you're a member in a tribe that is located in Colorado or is historically tied to Colorado. Similar for Oregon, and Oregon actually includes some bordering tribes. And if you go to the Oregon's website, it lists out all of those tribes. But same thing, it deems them residents for tuition purposes. So they're going to still pay resident tuition. I am not aware of a state that is waiving resident tuition to the extent that this provision goes. This is very, very generous and goes beyond what I have seen in other states.
Thank you. And I just want to be on the record. I'm supportive also. I mean, when you say abysmally low, we all know that. And we all in higher education know that this is the way out of poverty. So I'm very supportive, but I'm concerned about the fiscal, and I agree with my colleague, Regent Ariscotta, to bring this up in the future. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions and comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 13, Handbook Revision, Admission General Policy, SB 327, Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, Vice Chancellor for Academic Student Affairs and Community Colleges, I have before you a policy proposal to align the board's provisions concerning admissions to our universities with the provisions of Senate Bill 327. Essentially what, and this bill, by the way, was also signed by the governor, Chapter 296. Section 25 of the bill specifically indicates that the board must adopt a policy prohibiting discrimination. And they expanded that existing provision of state law to include reference to protective hairstyles, and then they provided a definition for race. Quickly on that, This board, 1 year ago, almost 1 year ago to date, adopted a policy within Chapter 8 that concerns a very broad non-discrimination policy. And I'm just going to read that into the record. And it says, this policy also prohibits any discrimination based on a person's clothing, traits historically associated with national origin, race, color, or religion, including but not limited to hair texture, hairstyle, or headwear. Now, that particular provision is broad and applies to employees. This is very, and it, when that piece was put in, they did not revise the provisions of Chapter 16 concerning admission. So you'll notice that when you look at the last three pages of the proposal, page 3 through 5, we are amending Title 4, Chapter 16, Section 5, Section 18, and Section 26, as each one is respect. The first one is universities, second one is state college, and the third one is community colleges. Those, the general anti-discrimination statement with respect to admissions. Now, I need to apologize because in preparing this material, we were focused on the original version of the bill, and in our haste to get this done, we missed the amendment. So I would like to read into the record, as this appears in the amendment that was adopted by the legislature, which is amendment number 250 to Senate Bill 327, the definition for race will now read, race includes traits associated with race, including without limitation, hair texture and protective hairstyles. So with respect to race, it deletes that reference to ancestry, color, ethnic group, identification, ethnic background, and the word historically. For the definition of protective hairstyle, that amendment revised the definition and broadened it by saying protective hairstyle includes, without limitation, hairstyles such as natural hairstyles, afros, Bantu knots, curls, braids, locks, and twists. So it includes the addition of natural hairstyles, afros, Bantu knots, and curls. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would request approval of this item as amended, as I have read that into the record. I will include it in writing in the chair's report so that it is properly codified, and that is with respect to Title 4, Chapter 15, Chapter 16, Section 5, 18, and 26.
Do I have a motion for approval of the policy as amended?
So moved.
Motion from Regent Carter. Second from Regent
Arascata.
Arascata. And I will note, as the Vice Chancellor Abba pointed out, we did adopt very similar policy a year ago, and we spent a year developing the policy with the students and the faculty and staff and through the Cultural Diversity Committee and brought it forward. And this really just translates it over to admissions with the amended language, as Vice Chancellor Abba pointed out there. And I think it's very good policy, and I encourage you all to support it. Seeing no other questions and comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 14, Handbook Revision, Residency and Financial Aid Programs, SB 347. Vice Chancellor Abba.
Thank you. For the record, Crystal Abba, Senate Bill 347 actually is an act related to sexual misconduct. However, in the latter hours of session, they took the provisions of AB 213 and amended them into this bill. The provisions that I am presenting to you today focus on that area, which is within the jurisdiction of this committee. So it's revisions in regards to tuition, the Governor Gwynne Millennium Scholarship, and the Promise Program. The provisions governing sexual misconduct will be presented at a later meeting by General Counsel Reynolds, who's in the process of working on those revisions now. So with that, I would refer you to begin page 3, which amends Title 4, Chapter 15, Section 3. Again, this is that section of the handbook where we deem individuals residents for tuition purposes. There is a provision in there for certain members of the armed forces, and it simply changes the word enrolled to admitted. And by doing so, that just broadens that window when they attend the institution and could qualify. So it really is kind of a technical change there. Continuing on to page 4, there's currently a provision in state law that individuals, when they meet the requirements for GGMS eligibility, they essentially are required to sign an affidavit. And that affidavit requires that they don't have to check the box on one of these three. They just have to sign the affidavit saying that I'm in one of these three boxes, which is I am a U.S. citizen, I am residing lawfully in the United States, or I am in the process of seeking legal immigration status. So again, those three options, they don't check one or the other. You're just saying I fall under one of those categories. And what the legislature did through enactment of this provision is essentially remove that affidavit requirement. So we are removing it here. And then finally, in Title IV, Chapter 18, Section 11, provisions governing the Nevada Promise Program, there was a prioritization there that the legislature removed. So in awarding those funds, they're removing the provision that says we're basically going to award FAFSA filers before we award non-FAFSA filers. So it simply takes that out. So that means they're all together in terms of funding. There are other provisions of 347 that is within the jurisdiction of this committee that are not being codified, including a provision in 396-540 that indicates that individuals who graduate from a Nevada high school would be considered residents for tuition purposes. This board actually adopted that, I want to say, 20 years ago. So that provision has been in place for some time, but they're now putting that into state law. That's actually a good thing, because I think then we get recognized on a lot of lists for other states that are doing that. There is also a provision in 347 that is permissive language that allows us, for the SSOG program, to put into place an application. Right now, the application is basically the FAFSA, but there are some students who are precluded by state law from completing the FAFSA. It would allow us to develop an application for non-FAFSA filers to identify their need, and then they could be participants in the SSOG program. We are in the process of working on that now. While it is permissive language, it will take some time because there are obviously PeopleSoft implementation issues. There are also issues with the equation engine that we have developed to identify those students and to determine their award amount. But it doesn't require codification in the handbook. So I wanted to let you know to be aware of that we are working on that. And that is it with respect to Senate Bill 347. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I would be happy to answer any questions and request your approval of what I just presented.
Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Carter.
So moved.
Second from Regent Arascata.
Yes.
Just a quick question, kind of back to the FAFSA report with the K-12 requirement of them having to assist students in FAFSA applications. What is our dialogue like when you're looking at the FAFSA alternative application for the financial aid side of it? Are we talking to K-12 and how we put those things together?
Let me give a shot at this, Renee, and then jump in. So in general, our institutions are constantly having those dialogues with K-12. And so we will be having those dialogues in regards to the change in the application. And while we weren't directly noted in the bill, they're not going to do those events without us because we really are the subject matter expert in that. But we are absolutely going to be having those conversations. And I would expect that in many cases, there are some institutions that are already having those dialogues because that's an imperative for us. That's our pipeline. I mean, yeah, good question, though. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We are now going to go back to item number 9, 2019-2020, Nishi-sponsored funding report. Mercy, are you? I'm assuming you're in Vegas or online.
Mr. Klinger is going to go look for her. I think she might be in the office here.
Okay. While they're doing that, I will grab number 15.
Can
new
you
business.
Hear me now?
Oh, there she is. There you are, Marcy. Okay. Gotcha. Go ahead.
Thank you. Sorry about that. For the record, Marcy Jackson. I'm the director of the System Sponsored Programs and EBSCOR office here in system administration. We are a unit under finance. And I know that we have a few new committee members today, so I'm gonna try and be very clear with my wording and make sure we don't use too many acronyms. But if I can get my slides up, SCS, that would be great. So for those of you that are new, you've probably heard of the term grant management for nonprofits and private industries in higher education, we use the term sponsored programs for external funding that comes in to support scholarly activities or other research. And these are funded through grants, contracts, and other types of mechanisms. And each campus has a sponsored program or a grant office. Our office, the System Sponsored Programs and ESCOR office, facilitates collaboration among the NG institutions on multi-state, multi-institution grants that are statewide, such as NSF EBSCOR, NASA EBSCOR, and NASA Space Grant. And EBSCOR stands for the Established Program to Stimulate Competitive Research, which is a special type of federal funding. We also manage, with the program staff, the system-sponsored programs, which include things like the Foster Youth Initiative that you've probably heard about, as well as the new Nevada Alliance for Youth Apprenticeships. So we work directly with the system, with the sponsored programs offices at each of the institutions and faculty throughout the state. This report is a compilation of the self-reported extramural funding from each of our institutions, and it gives you, the Regents, one source of information about the annual sponsor funding. The full report is in the meeting materials, but we'll go through the highlights here. Next slide, please. So sponsor programs do support all of our NG strategic goals. Of course, we're working to raise Nevada's research profile, but we also bring in funding for access and closing the achievement gap through preparatory services for our low-income and first-generation students. Our success goal brings, we have bringing in funds for tutoring and counseling. And of course, we work closely with many of the state agencies to work on workforce goals through industry needs with certificates and training programs. Next slide, please. If you look way back, you'll see that our numbers are a little bit different than they were in the past. We've got a new baseline for this report in 2016 because previous to that, we had some of the Title IV financial aid that was included, such as the Pell Grants. We took those out because they really aren't sponsored programs. So as you can see from 2016, we've increased our total awards over $100 million since then. And we had a 34% increase in fiscal year 19 to fiscal year 20. Next slide. Part of the reason for that increase was the COVID-19 crisis. The federal government made available extra funding to institutions of higher education through the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act, also known as the CARES Act. And our NG institutions received $73 million in CARES funding, as well as $10 million in COVID-related funding that were projects around the pandemic and the virus. Next slide, please. So this pie chart shows how much funding each of our institutions received in fiscal year 20. The amount of the funding received by NG institutions varies greatly based on the mission and size of the institution. We'll dive more into that in the slides. But on the right-hand side, you can see how much direct federal funding we received. That's significant because that tells us we're being competitive on the national scene. Overall, we had 64% of our sponsor programs was direct federal funding. It's also important to note this year that there was a 1,200% increase in scholarships and fellowships due to CARE Act funding. Next slide. So the next few slides will highlight each of the institutions, some of their successes, some of their challenges, or projects that they want to highlight. You'll have slides. The slides will all have different numbers on there, and I'll give you some background as we go through. But we list the increases or decreases in the sponsor funding awards that have come into an institution, and those are sorted into groups: research, student services, public services, instruction, scholarships, and other. So UNLV increased their awards by $30 million in fiscal year 20, and they had $25.5 million in CARES Act. The federal funding increased by $7.4 million that year. And UNLV really wanted to highlight the importance of sponsored programs with the United Health Foundation, which was an early supporter of the Kirk Kerkorian School of Medicine. They funded a $3 million grant, which led to an innovative new curriculum for the school. The grant partnership was created in response to a critical shortage of physicians in the state and in primary care specifically. They also received additional funding this year from the National Institutes of Health, NIH, the Health Resources and Services Administration, HRSA, and the U.S. Department of Education. Next slide. From fiscal year 19 to 20, UNR had an increase in awards of $19.7 million. They received $22.5 million in CARES Act and $9.1 million in COVID-related funding. The medical school, UNR Med, also had an increase of $5.6 million. New projects include a partnership with University of California, San Diego, for the Pacific Gas and Electric Company Territory Alert Wildfire Project to support fire ignition confirmation, so important during this drought season. Research was affected at the university by the pandemic, and all human resource research was halted until safety protocols were updated, and access to labs were restricted, and the researchers had to work remotely. Next slide, please. CRI has seen a significant increase of 24.3% in sponsored programs from fiscal year 19 to 20. The gains include a 36% increase in direct federal funding, as well as significant gains from the state of Nevada, other state and local governments, and federal pass-through dollars. CRI received $1.4 million in CARES Act, as well as $900,000 in COVID-related funding. CRI was selected by the Nevada Governor's Office of Science, Innovation, and Technology, also known as OSINT, you'll hear that throughout the rest of the report, to lead three regional networks designed to increase student interest and achievements in STEM. And they also partnered with the Environmental Defense Fund, NASA, and Google to develop a web application that will help fill the data gap in water management. And then you probably all saw in the news their work in microplastics. Next slide, please.
Marcy, just real quick. And I don't know if it's for you or for President Acharya, but I thought when we got the report on the CARES Act that DRI wasn't eligible for that funding, but it looked in the previous slide and there you said that they did receive some, and I'm just curious what categories those were in.
Chair, Garrett, I can take that. I can explain that.
Report I received.
Marcy, yes, do you want to take that? Yep.
Yes.
Thank you. That was the money, Chair Gary, is given to us for COVID research. So that was the CARES Act money that came to the state, and then the state then allocated for different COVID research, part of which we ended up getting for four different projects. So it was not a direct money like other institutions that came either for students for other COVID-related relief. This is primarily for research.
Thank you, President Acharya.
Yeah.
Thank you, Marcy. Sorry for the interruption.
Okay.
Continue.
NSE had an increase of $2.4 million in awards with $4 million in CARES Act funding. They partnered with DRI and CSN on Nevada's GeoGateway program to substantially increase the diversity and number of students graduating from NSE with geosciences degrees. They're the only four-year institution in Southern Nevada with an environmental and resources BS. Okay, I'm going to do another big, long title here that we'll hear throughout the rest of the report. The IDEA Network of Biomedical Research Excellence, known as EMBRE, which is funded by the National Institutes of Health, created the Faculty-Led Authentic Research Experience, or FLARE, project. The implementation had to be revised due to the pandemic, but they were able to get four students to sign up for this one-on-one learning experience with a faculty member. And they had an increase of 11.5% in their Teacher Academy Pipeline project. Next slide. CSN had an overall increase of $16.5 million in awards with just over $14 million in CARES Act funding. OSIT funded the purchase of state-of-the-art laboratory instruments and equipment to support the creation of a new mineralogy course. And the Governor's Office on Workforce Innovations for a New Nevada, or OWIN, supported an advanced manufacturing grant for equipment, instructor pay, student assessment, and certification costs. An MBRA funded a study on fecal chloroforms present in samples from Las Vegas Valley ice cream shops, which I may or may not want to know the results of. And CSN continued to be active in the Nevada Space Grants Consortium with a variety of projects. Next slide, please. DBC had an overall increase of 91,000 in awards. They received 500,000 in CARES Act funding. They received their second ever direct funding from the National Science Foundation in collaboration with UNR and the University of Cincinnati, which allowed the PI and students to study the Pleasant Valley earthquake ruptures. OSIT also funded a construction technology program at Elko High School, allowing the purchase of equipment for workforce training in construction and HVAC. And the Nevada Department of Education College and Career Readiness Grant funded tuition and textbooks for dual enrollment students throughout the GBC service area until it was cut by the legislature in 21. Next slide. TMCC had an overall increase of awards by 4 million, including 3.4 million in CARES Act. They received $140,000 for an expanding community college apprenticeship initiative, which will go over 3 years. Those funds are being used to provide support services such as textbooks and course materials for registered apprenticeships in targeted industries, including construction and healthcare. And MBRA and NASA Space Grant continue to provide undergraduate research projects for TMCC students, with a large portion of student researchers coming from minority populations. Next slide. WNC doubled their awards in fiscal year 20, including 1.65 million in CARES Act, of which 700,000 was distributed to students during the spring, summer, and fall of 2020. CARES funding was also used to purchase technology for students and faculty, as well as PPE and new ventilation equipment. Private donors supplied funds for dual enrollment programs, student laptops, and scholarships. And OSIT, again, was there to provide funds for technology and increases in EMS and paramedic programs. The Governor's Office on Economic Development, also known as GOED, the Pennington Foundation, Tesla Motors, and Wells Fargo funded a mobile technology lab that rolled through the quad counties to provide access for the rural students in the applied industry technology programs. And MBRA and NASA Space Grant afforded hands-on research activities for students. Next slide. This table shows the interinstitutional collaboration among our institutions. These are subawards that one institution has given to another so they can work on a project together. As I noted at the beginning of the presentation, the function of our office is to facilitate statewide and multi-institution projects, which is why our subaward number is so high. Overall, there were 101 projects funded through collaborations in fiscal year 20. Next slide, please. This table shows the number of proposals submitted and received in fiscal year 20. The total doesn't exactly match Appendix A due to awarding time or announcement of intent to fund, but we did have a 15% increase in proposals submitted from fiscal year 19. Now, last year, Agent Carter had a question tying the proposals from this screen to Appendix B, where we list the direct federal awards that were received. And I did check with the institutions, and we did submit proposals to 20 out of the 22 agencies listed in Appendix B. The only two federal agencies we had not sent proposals to in fiscal year 20 were HUD and VA. So it is a competitive environment. We don't get funded for all the proposals that we send in, but our researchers and faculty are working. Next slide, please.
Mr. Chair, real quick while we're on that slide, if you don't mind.
Yes, Regent Carter.
I just want to point out, if you do some quick math too, and thank you for that answer as well for my question a little while back, but if you do some quick math on this, you can see our community colleges and Nevada State College are doing fantastic with the percentage of accepted applications. I think that, you know, hopefully we can motivate them to submit even more, because their success rate is so high on getting these grants and projects approved.
Thank you. Continue, Marcy.
Okay, and so this slide shows the distribution of state program match funds. These are state funds that we use to do the required cost share for federal projects that are statewide, including NSF EBSCOR, NASA EBSCOR, the Department of Education statewide GEAR UP grant, NASA space grant, and then there's some infrastructure for our office. And the percentage of funds that go out to the institution varies year to year because most of these funds that go to the institutions are based on competitive solicitations or seed grants for research or instruction programs and for scholarships and fellowships. So the numbers will go up and down based upon the number of proposals that we receive in and the ones that are deemed to be eligible. Because of the timing of our federal awards this year, we did have a delay in getting some of the state sub-awards out, but by August, we had another 800,000 that had been. Next slide, please. So overall, our institutions brought in $329.7 million. That includes $73 million in CARES Act funding. Our researchers and other faculty and staff do spend a lot of time trying to bring in money to support their projects, their research, their creative endeavors, and we appreciate all that they do, and their sponsor programs and grants offices that are there to support them through the process of submitting the proposals and then managing those awards. And that is the end of my presentation. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to see what I can answer.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? I have two. One is as you know, every year, I do like the intra-system collaboration slide. I want to encourage our institutions and the presidents and the faculty to continue to work together and apply for grants together and collaborate wherever they can. Even if you look at our total as a state, we're still small compared to a lot of institutions around the country in research dollars, and I think it helps us all out when we work together. The other just comment for next year's report, Marcy, is if we could, I don't know, footnote those CARES Act dollars cleanly. I'm afraid we're going to have that blip for this year on those slides for all the institutions based on what they got coming in directly from the CARES Act. And I don't want us to think there was a big drop off next year, the year after, when those funds are no longer available. So I want to make sure that we're tracking everything that they're applying for and getting as well. So just a footnote or asterisk in those slides about how much of that was CARES would be great.
Sure.
And thank you. And with that, that was an info only, and I love that presentation. I have a question from Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. Back to Marcy, thank you for the presentation. It's interesting. And I noticed a big difference between UNR and UNLV. Is that attributable to the fact that the person that was head of research left UNLV and they did a national search? I mean, it was quite significant, the difference. And I know we just got it, they just announced a new person in that role for UNLV, so I would expect to see the numbers much higher for them next year. Am I correct in thinking that?
Well, if you look at historically, UNR has always had a higher level of funding because of the size, and so I know that UNLV has some new leadership coming in, and they are increasing some of their faculty as well. So we'll see how it goes in the future.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions or comments, item number 15, new business. Is there any new business for the RSUG committee?
Mr. Chair, if I may, Laura Perkins for the record.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you. Earlier, Vice Chancellor Abba mentioned about the tribe affiliation. Is that a possible, just throwing this out there, yes, it does say a Native American or Alaska Native, but can we put like a checkbox in there that delineates which tribe they're from to make it easier for us to track or keep count of, or get a more accurate count of how many Native Americans that are in Nevada? That was the first one. And one more, how about a discussion on students that need funding, like at the community college level for immediate like recertifications? Can we have some type of discussion? Because if you're going to advance yourself and you need a certification to get promoted, FAFSA takes too long, Pell Grant takes too long, and then we kind of lose our momentum to help those students and help those individuals maybe get a raise or get a, you know, better job or diversify our economy. So can we have that discussion about maybe some solution for that?
I will discuss it with the Community College Committee Chair, but one of us can make sure and get a report back on the certifications and what financial aid is available. So we'll definitely either bring that through ours or the Community College Committee, but that's a good idea. And we'll get those reports from the campuses. And as to your first question, Vice Chancellor Abba.
For the record, Crystal Abba, and I apologize, I should have mentioned this on the record in the presentation, but we will be developing a system-wide form for the Native American fee waiver so that we are making sure that we're collecting all the appropriate information, including which tribe they are from. So thank
you. Great minds think alike. Thank you.
Any other new business? Sorry, just going back through my notes. Just so the committee is aware, we want to update on the foster youth fee waiver, and we'd like a report in September on the foster youth fee waiver, including number of foster youth that have used the waiver to date and what the associated cost of that program is. We would also like an update on co-requisite instruction to get a report from Complete College America to gain their perspective on our implementation efforts, how it's going, and it'd be a good time to hear from each one of the institutions as far as math and English in terms of how it's working on their campuses and bringing it forward, and what are the things we may need to change to improve that program. So we'll bring those forward in the next few months. And with that, I'll go to public comment in Las Vegas. Is there any public comment in Las Vegas?
No.
Winter,
comment.
Have you received? I'm sorry, what?
No public comment, not online or anyone in person.
Thank you. And there is no one in Reno either. So with that, the committee is adjourned. Thank you all.